You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Welcome to Brookings. I'm Martin Indyk, the director of the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings. And it is my distinct pleasure to have the opportunity to introduce you to the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Cyprus, Yannis Kassoulidis, to address this special Statesman's Forum at Brookings. I also want to welcome Senator Paul Sarbanes. It's very good to have you here. It's an honor for us, Senator. We're great admirers of all the work that you did in your days in the Senate, and also the Ambassador of Greece and the Chargé d'Affaires of Cyprus. The Foreign Minister has a very distinguished career as politician and diplomat. He served in the Cypriot government from 1993 to 1997 as its spokesman. He was first appointed Minister of Foreign Affairs in 1997 and served in that capacity for 6 years. During that time, he led the diplomatic effort that marked the initiation and completion of Cyprus's accession to the European Union. From 2004 to 2013, Minister Kassoulidis was a member of the European Parliament, where he served as the Vice President of the European People's Party and head of its Foreign Affairs Working Group. In 2013, he was appointed Foreign Minister again for his second term. I believe it was in March of this year. He has taken office at a rather dramatic time for Cyprus. We don't need to be reminded of one of those dramas, which, of course, was the banking crisis of earlier this year. But it's dramatic for a number of other reasons as well. Cyprus has just finished an important role as head of the European Union. The discovery of offshore gas in voluminous quantities offshore Cyprus has opened up a whole new opportunity and question mark that I hope the minister will address today. And, of course, the economic crisis, as the Chinese say, out of every crisis can come an opportunity, I think also presents an opportunity for Cyprus. And that's the context in which the Foreign Minister is going to speak to us today about the geopolitics of the Eastern Mediterranean and give us his Cypriot perspective. And after he's addressed us, we'll have an opportunity for a conversation and to ask him a few questions. Minister Kassoulidis, welcome.
Well, Senator Sarbanes, Your Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, I would like to thank very much the Brookings Institute for giving me this opportunity to be speaking today, and thank very much for bringing around so many good people, among them some people that I do know very well. So I would like to thank you very much for your presence, and I want also to thank you very much, Mr. Ambassador, for chairing this meeting and moderating it. I know that the subject I will be talking about is so dear to you and your particular interest in the Middle East, something that cannot leave Cyprus indifferent, because indeed I would like to put my speech and talk about Cyprus within the perspective of the bigger picture of the region of the Eastern Mediterranean. The problem of Cyprus should not be seen as an isolated problem. It's not a problem which concerns only the interested parties. It's a problem that it's very much related to the stability and the security of the region, the volatile region of the Eastern Mediterranean, which, as you know, is among the most security-prone areas in the world, despite the fact that nowadays, with the emerging powers and other characteristics, perhaps other parts of the world have become much more important than they used to be, the Pacific, etc. But how can one ignore our region, from where international terrorism was born, from where we have Iran with the potentiality of acquiring the nuclear weapon, from where we have the influence it's exerting to Hezbollah in Lebanon, to Syria, and the conflict in Syria, a region where we have Syria itself, and the very dramatic situation with loss of lives and properties in that country, from where we have the Middle East problem, Lebanon, with the fact a country that was the theater of wars by proxy, not just one, but several, and then Egypt and the Arab Spring and the extremely important developments there. And the middle of it all, geographically, Cyprus is situated. And I would like to be allowed to talk about it, particularly since Cyprus is at the same time a member of the European Union, belongs without any doubt in the Western security system it always belonged to, despite some several foreign policy attitudes by some governments wishing that they were in the non-aligned line of world. They were not. And finally, there is Israel and its security and the importance about the fact that Cyprus is next door to this country. So allow me, first of all, to speak about this importance of the geographic location of Cyprus, which creates for Cyprus great challenges, but also which is offering also, if our foreign policy is creative, great opportunities. Only today, to give you an example, I was informed from Nicosia that Iran has decided to recall its ambassador there for consultations. Why? Because an Iranian citizen was apprehended for trying to sell or to buy, sorry, to contravene the arms embargo against Iran. And the Cypriot courts decided, and the decision was applied by the government of Cyprus to extradite this individual to the United States. So Cyprus is not immune from problems in this region. Recently we had an individual who was sentenced to 4 years in prison by a Cypriot court when he confessed that he was a member of Hezbollah and he was trying to collect information regarding the whereabouts of Israeli tourists in Cyprus, probably conspiring for a terrorist attack similar to the one that has taken place in Bulgaria for the same reason. Well, for us, for the new government of Cyprus, we want to be an important partner of the United States and the European Union to the fight against terrorism, to the fight against proliferation of nuclear weapons, organized crime, trafficking of human beings, etc. I think that we are useful despite our small size because we are in this particular part of the world. We are among the first countries that have joined the Proliferation Security Initiative of the United States for this effect. And let me take the occasion here to express our deep sorrow for the victims of the terrorist attack in Boston, which is here to show that this asymmetrical security issue, which is called terrorism, is something that is not going to leave us alone, and we'll always have to maintain our vigilance. But also, I think that there are other issues now that are becoming important for the rest of the world. It's the energy and maritime security, for which I will speak in a minute. I want to say that by being members of the European Union, we became members of the European Union because we share with the other members the similar values, which are common also to the United States of America: democracy, human rights, and the rule of law. And we aspire to be partners both to the EU and to the USA regarding trade, shipping, and investments. But the recent hydrocarbon discoveries, it's a very important new development in our region. It can contribute to the EU energy security and the diversification policy of the EU. But it is also the fact that Cyprus is situated at the strategic point of entrance at the Suez Canal for gas exports to Asia markets. And indeed, one of the companies that got interested and acquired contracts in the Cypriot exclusive economic zone is KOGAS, a South Korean company. We will exploit our gas resources. I don't think that anybody's claim that we can do otherwise can ignore the fact that despite the progress of new technologies and the fact that other kind of energies are going to become available, like shale gas, both in the United States and elsewhere, the demand remains still high, particularly in Asia, where a lot of people are still in the way to development, which we haven't seen the end yet. I don't think that humanity is permitted to sit down and wait until Cyprus settles its problems with Turkey in order to proceed in exploiting this very important material. We do all our actions on natural gas follow the UN Convention for the Law of the Sea and the international law, and we anticipate by the end of this decade the first important revenues from this issue. Noble Energy, an American company, and probably behind this company other American companies that I am not permitted to disclose myself, it's not my job, but also in cooperation with an Israeli company who acquired 30%, has already acquired one block from which the first drilling took place with success, and the this company is also negotiating now about the terms of the pipeline, bringing the gas onshore, and then to create a power station using the LNG, natural gas for Europe. I know that there is a lot of word about and plans about pipelines, but pipelines cannot be the only mean of exporting natural gas, because pipelines, they may be cheaper, but one has to be sure that the source from where they are coming from, the transit from where they are passing from, are predictable areas, and therefore the advantage of the LNG is that it can go anywhere through the sea, both for Europe, but also for the markets of Asia, which are very demanding for consuming at the moment. But this natural gas has brought important new and tangible ways for Cyprus to work together with its neighbors. We are living in a neighborhood that, first of all, we had the developments of the Arab Spring. We have all welcomed the fact that the Arab world has decided that it cannot be the exception in the development of democracy. Of course, it is still a big debate among themselves to find their way to true democracy. We are going to see ups and downs on this road, but is a road that will not have its way back. And I believe that both the United States and the European Union have to be there to make sure that these democratic developments in the Arab world and in our vicinity not only consolidate democracy, but at the same time adhere to the values that we all share and can become a factor of stability rather than the other way around. We are the only member state of the European Union that we belong to this region I am describing. And I want to begin talking about how we view Israel. Cyprus, in my view, is the most predictable next-door neighbor of Israel. We are the only country that is not party to the Middle East problem, the only country that we are not potentially a fundamentalist country from now or forever. We are the only country that is a member of the European Union, as Jason Shimon Peres said 2 days ago during the visit of President Anastasiadis to Jerusalem, that Cyprus brought Europe to 35 minutes away from Tel Aviv, whereas before it was the distance was much, much bigger. This theory always existed, and the good intentions between Cyprus and Israel always existed. But now the energy issue becomes the tangible area from where we can work together and make and prove what we have been saying about this. When I said that we are the most predictable country, neighbor of Israel, it includes all the other neighbors, even those neighbors that are now governed by moderate regimes, and perhaps they are okay. Jordan, for instance. But the question is, can anybody predict what the case will be in 10 years from now? Turkey is another example. And we have all seen, of course, understandable the efforts to resolve the misunderstandings. And probably they will be. But the predictability will never be there. And on the contrary, Cyprus, whichever government is in power in Cyprus, we've seen the left government a few months ago, we are now seeing a center-right government, the predictability, it's undeniable. Except for one matter, and I want to use it now, except if there is a bad settlement of the Cyprus question, a settlement which may lead to the fact that Turkey may allow through proxy to dominate or influence its foreign policy, because in such a case, this only very important card for Israel, a very important ally for the United States, of predictability, will cease to exist. Now, I want to make sure to my audience that what we are doing with Israel and the way we are working with Israel was never seen and will never be seen as a zero-sum game so far as Turkey is concerned. We don't believe in the foreign policy which says that the friend of your enemy is no longer your friend. There is no such a thing. Besides, nowadays there are no friends and no enemies, but that's a different story. And secondly, as we share common values with Israel, and also Greece shares common values with Israel, and we may be working on agreements, tripartite agreements, this should never be seen and was never intended to be an anti-Turkish front. It was because it's a parallel path of matters that are of common concern, and we need to work together with them. I think that there is another asset that has to be seen with great attention. Our economic zone has adjacent borders with the economic zone of Israel, adjacent borders with the economic zone of Egypt, adjacent borders, the median line, with the economic zone of Lebanon. And Israel has one common adjacent line of the economic zone between Israel and Lebanon, and another adjacent line between Israel and Egypt. Common denominator, Cyprus. Cyprus has excellent relations, had always had, traditionally, but with affinity, both with Egypt and with Lebanon. I will speak in a minute about them. So it is extremely important that Cyprus plays the role of bringing Israel and Lebanon, along with Israel in itself, in this equation. We are now negotiating with Israel an agreement on common exploitation of natural gas that is adjacent to our respective economic zones. And we also began just now negotiations about the security It is called Dialogue for the Strategic Energy Security and the General Stability in our region. It includes questions of energy security, but also on other areas of common interest like terrorism, non-proliferation, and so on, other issues that we can work together. In this agreement, we are talking from now that we would like to bring in and introduce Egypt and Lebanon and facilitate, when the time is ripe, to succeed this. And that is why this is another important issue that it has to be taken into account. We view ourselves in the dispute, both in the Middle East problem, but also in other disagreements between Israel and its neighbors, the other neighbors, as a facilitator and not just as an observer. Now, as I have mentioned before, Lebanon is a very, for us, is a country that we have great affinity. We have hosted twice a great number of refugees, in particular members of the business community of Lebanon in Cyprus. They have established companies now, and they make this clever choice of having an office in Nicosia or in Limassol or wherever in Cyprus. So when there is a crisis in their own country, they don't stop their operations. They continue them from our country. And I am glad to say that some businessmen from Haifa, after the last war where the missiles were landing indiscriminately, which paralyzed the economic activities in the town, have also chosen to do the same. I may also recall that in October 1983, when the lives of 241 American Marines were lost in Beirut, Cyprus was there to offer immediately its services and its facilities for humanitarian and other support. And the same is that now we have made agreements with a number of EU, but also non-EU countries for the evacuation of 1,000 citizens from the EU, from the United States, from Canada and others that may be needing evacuation in case the situation in Syria becomes much worse. The relations with Egypt date from the time of before the independence of Cyprus. And they have remained always very cordial. I am planning to visit Egypt after I have visited Israel and after my president visited Israel. Now I will visit Egypt, and then President Anastasiadis will follow. I always go first for the preparation of the meetings. And I hope that while it is understandable that there is great domestic, there are big domestic problems in Egypt, and perhaps all the factors are trying to find the specific role that they need to play from within the European Union. We are giving all the encouragement to Baroness Ashton and to Bernardino León to try and broker a better understanding within a democracy of what is the role of the majority and the government on the one hand and the opposition in the other. Now I come, if I am allowed, to Syria. Because Syria, I must make a distinction. The people of Cyprus, due to the proximity and to the great exchanges among people to people, has always been very close to the Syrian people. And now we are expressing our great concern about what is going on, particularly being spectators of so many lives being lost, particularly among innocent civilians, and of so much destruction that is taking place in this country. We are also very concerned regarding the minorities in Syria. Syria has always been, traditionally, despite the fact that the first disciples of both Christianity and Islam made Damascus the second capital, Syria has always remained a secular country. But now it is facing very serious problems. Of greater concern to the minorities is the problem of the jihadism, which has invaded the country, and even when the Assad regime is gone, it will still be another war before this is also addressed to. I have said to the Secretary General of the UN yesterday that Cyprus is supporting his efforts and is offering all assistance to his team that he dispatched there to investigate regarding the use of chemical weapons. The use of chemical weapons is a great concern of everybody, particularly if they fell into the wrong hands. That is why we believe that the situation on the ground needs to change soon in order that the sides realize that there is no other way but to come to the negotiating table and reach a political solution. Of course, a political solution which will mean that President Assad must step aside. There is no other solution for any regime anywhere in the world who turns its weapons against its own people, particularly even heavy weapons, in order to contemplate that there is no other way. And we are now debating within the European Union, and most probably will take a decision by the Foreign Affairs Council next May regarding taking bold decisions ourselves as to how the situation of the ground will change. It's very asymmetrical, you know. If a country like Iran provides weapons and sustains the one side, the Assad regime side, and leaving the others and wait that they will accept the conditions so they can be brought to the negotiating table and find a political solution. That's not the way that the sides will be convinced to sit at the negotiating table. Now let me talk a little bit about Turkey, which is the last part of my intervention. Turkey is a very important ally of the United States, and nobody wants to dispute this. And it's an important country, a country that has been successful since Mr. Erdogan came to power, an emerging economy with great successes, and also a country that after some doubts about to which side should be on, it has took the side of the opposition against the Assad regime and is also playing its role in the humanitarian aspect of receiving the refugees, both in Turkey, but also, since I say this, let's mention also Jordan and Iraq, and of course Lebanon, where things are not as simple as taking over refugees. They have the tendency to take sides and therefore to bring the civil war into their own country. But going back to Turkey, let me say that Turkey has also tried with the dogma of Mr. Davutoglu, the foreign minister, about zero problems with the neighbors. It has initially worked with mediating about the Golan Heights between Israel and Syria, the Assad Syria. It has worked with Hamas, as you know. It has worked with Iran. You remember the efforts to bring uranium into Turkey and the fact that this contradicted a bit the efforts of the Security Council to introduce sanctions at the time. But anyhow, they tried. But I believe that all this of this policy has not succeeded in the end, although understandable policy. And the zero problems with the neighbors is just in theory. On the contrary, there are problems with all the neighbors. So much so that certain attitudes of turning the back to the European Union and believing in the Eurasia project and I don't know what else, it's not a very realistic choice either. So Turkey now is trying to convince everybody, and I will wait to see whether this is truthful or not. It's trying to convince everybody that wants to turn again towards the European Union and acknowledges that the problem of Cyprus is an impediment for this. And also that I hope that Turkey understands what an anachronism it is nowadays to occupy 37% of the territory of Cyprus, 57% of its coastline, a European country, after all, therefore a European soil. And how anachronistic it is to admit openly, as Mr. Davutoglu did, that even if there was one Turkish Cypriot in Cyprus, Turkey cannot remain disinterested to what will happen on this island, which is right at the hypogastrium of Turkey and the maritime routes from Ceyhan and elsewhere. And let me tell you that this was the admission of a previous of Turkish foreign minister, Mr. Soysal, who has openly said that they are in Cyprus not for the security of the Turkish Cypriots, as it is portrayed, but for these specific reasons. Anyhow, I don't intend to use this rostrum in using enmity language, as I was told, towards Turkey. On the contrary, I want to see the future in an open way. That is why, since we came to power, 1st of March, and despite what we have received, that it was waiting and prepared for us by the decision of the Eurogroup regarding the bail-in, we have decided that we will proceed with our policy of finding solutions to problems and not hide behind chronic stalemates And that is why we wanted to send, and we will be continue sending, signals to Turkey about our positive attitude. First of all, you should know that since our accession to the European Union, Turkey blocks the political dialogue between NATO and the European Union on the pretext that Cyprus has no connection whatsoever with NATO. It's participating in no programs with NATO, and it is true that Cyprus is the only European Union member which has no kind of connection or participates in any way in the programs of NATO. So the government of President Anastasiadis is prepared to address this issue. And we say we are ready to apply to participate in the program for the Partnership for Peace. In exchange, we are offering to Turkey to lift the veto on its participation in the administrative arrangements with the European Defense Agency. It's a fair deal, provided that Turkey doesn't object by a veto in our participation in the Partnership for Peace, which will resolve not our problem. We can be without PFP for another 10 years, for that matter. But we'll give the opportunity to save a problem between the European Union and NATO. And it is not a non-important issue. It's a very important problem. Because when political missions of the European Union go, let's say, to Afghanistan, an agreement is needed at that level regarding the security of these people from the contingents that there are in Afghanistan. And this is missing. So let's not underestimate that this is a very important matter for the relations between the EU and NATO. We are offering the solution. Still, we don't get the necessary positive replies. But we will leave time to Baroness Ashton, to the American government, to continue working with the hope that this will be successful in the end. We don't want to play the blame game here. And just go and put the application, Turkey to veto us, and then come and say, you see, we told you. First, we want to try seriously, but there will be a time when we shall have to do it. Secondly, the economic crisis in Cyprus has created something that it is a very important factor if we are seeking to find a solution. This important factor is public opinion. As you know, in 2004, public opinion voted against the proposed Annan Plan. President Anastasiadis, that has been weakened now from the economic developments, needs the support of the public opinion in Cyprus in order to deliver. We are proposing a fair deal for everybody to take place in parallel. I don't know. We are open of lifting our own veto on certain subjects of the accession negotiation chapter, certain chapters of the accession negotiation of Turkey with the European Union, a win situation for Turkey. Permit direct trade of the Turkish Cypriot community through the port of Famagusta under the supervision of the European Union, a win situation for the Turkish Cypriots. And we want that Turkey relinquishes the town of Famagusta, an empty town, a ghost town, to its rightful inhabitants, which is a win situation for Cyprus. So a win situation. And I am saying that such a big step, it is a big step. It's not a small CBM or whatever. But such a big step will tremendously change the whole climate, and it will become the game changer if we want during the negotiations to resolve the problem of Cyprus. It will be a game changer, I assure you, because there is one issue, and it is always a usual thing with all problems that are characterized by chronicity: lack of trust. If we can diminish this gap of trust that exists, and by Turkey doing this on Famagusta, we'll certainly respond to this, it will be a tremendous development. We are committed that we will begin the talks for the substance of the problem by next autumn. We want them well prepared. We want that the negotiators, who are the leaders of the communities, appoint interlocutors. You know, they all say, good officers' mission of the United Nations, fine. Intercommunal talks, fine. But there is something here that we pretend it does not exist. The major difference is between Turkey and Cyprus. It's not between the two communities in Cyprus. Therefore, somewhere, Turkey has to be involved in these negotiations. Turkey does not accept to speak with us because they say they don't recognize the Republic of Cyprus. Fine. An interlocutor will have no institutional connection with the Republic of Cyprus. He will be somebody representing the Greek Cypriot community. They can speak to him. There is no further excuse. To listen to them, and having us listened, and address the concerns that exist from both sides. So, I am not going to say to you that the negotiations for Cyprus are easy. They have never been. But whoever wants to be involved in these negotiations have to have in mind that something is needed in order to change. Mr. Davutoglu has acknowledged publicly that President Anastasiadis and his election creates a window of opportunity. President Anastasiadis has the credentials from his past history, and everybody knows that if bold decisions are needed, he will not hesitate to take them. But the window of opportunity cannot be a matter concerning only just an election of a new government. It needs both sides to send their own signals, not in a zero-sum situation where we believe that Turkey wants urgently negotiations because they want to take advantage of our economic weakness of the presence, and them saying that the reason we want to begin negotiations in October and not now are excuses about our economic situation, and we are trying to the delaying tactics. These are suspicions that are totally unnecessary if we mean business. If we mean business, we have the political will, and you will see it. I want to finish very quickly by reminding everybody that today is Europe's Day. Today is in Europe the day we celebrate Europe. Europe and its values, the strongest ally of the United States and the most valued partner. Despite the problems in the Eurozone, despite the fact that we have to admit the failures of certain aspects of the European project, we must also say that the EU is a unifier. It's a factor of stability and prosperity for its people. It has always been, and it will be there. People may be disappointed. The people of Cyprus are disappointed the way they were handled on the 16th of March and the 21st of March. But we don't accept that we're less Europeans than those that have taken the decisions. We are much more in favor of European integration than anybody else. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Foreign Minister Kasoulidis. That was a tour d'horizon, and I thought you were going to avoid mentioning Turkey completely until I realized that you left the best till last. Let me ask you in that regard, since you've been a veteran of these issues with Turkey for so many years. Is there something about this particular time that makes it more propitious to try to resolve the problems?
Yes, as I have mentioned, there is the argument that is convincing coming from Turkey, is that Turkey, having tried all the other policies about zero problems with the neighbors, about looking towards a Eurasian design, wishes to turn now back to the European Union, and that acknowledges that the Cyprus problem, the existence of the Cyprus problem, is an impediment, and they say the time has come in order to resolve it. Now, I am sorry, I wish and I hope it is true. It remains to be proven at the negotiating table. But Turkey has trained us to believe that we need to see before we believe. And because it is not the first time that we see this kind of very well enveloped, nicely prepared gift with a nice paper outside, but almost nothing inside. Let's see what is going to be. I don't think that we should miss opportunities or send away opportunities. We need to test it.
Does the crisis that Cyprus has just been through, economic crisis, affect this dynamic in any way?
Well, this is a double sword argument, and I want to explain why. First of all, if it is used, it may make people, particularly Cypriots, become suspicious that all this happened, the decisions taken by the Eurogroup, etc., in order to bring Cyprus to its knees and accept a settlement that is in adverse terms. Secondly, this argument has, I don't deny at all, the medium-term and long-term economic advantages. But I cannot see the short-term economic advantages when one knows that, first of all, those displaced persons that have lost their properties, they need compensation if they choose so. Turkish Cypriots or others who need to be relocated because of territorial adjustments will also need to get money and support in order to succeed in this. Inaugurating a new civil service and an administration composed, I mean, we need four parliaments, for instance. And all these arguments bring to the question, who is going to pay for all these costs? Definitely, it will not be somebody from abroad. There are so many urgent and much more important humanitarian issues around the world to feel that this can be done from abroad. Usually, and in the past, the idea was to be paid by the Cypriots themselves. Now, how can it be done? So I, in my view, using the economic argument is going to be counterproductive. There are reasons enough why a country bleeding from the wounds of being divided needs to be reunited. I don't think an additional arguments are necessary.
But in the geostrategic context in which this problem confronts you,
yes,
there's that element, that is to say the economic crisis. There are two other elements. One is the rapprochement between Israel and Turkey. And the second is, of course, what you referred to as this natural gas bonanza. Do those two factors have any play in terms of influencing the context for a resolution of this problem?
Yes, particularly the second, because I believe the Israelis when they say that perhaps they need to improve further the relations with Turkey out of need, but in parallel they need to improve further the relations with Cyprus and with Greece out of communality of values. And I believe them when they say that things will not be as they were before, the problems between Israel and Turkey. We still have our role to play by not considering the Israeli-Turkish rapprochement as a zero-sum game for us, neither considering our relationship with Israel as anything having to do as a front against Turkey. It is totally two parallel roads who never need to meet. Now, the second is the question of energy. If the question of energy is used in its right context, it can be an important motivation for everybody in order to resolve the problem. It would be a very good incentive. But if it's used as a threat of use of force, it will be counterproductive, it will create other ramifications. Let me give two examples where I think it would be a very good incentive. First of all, Israel, I know, that would like to have a diversification of the ways they will be exporting natural gas if they finally decide that they will be exporting natural gas, because the decision has not yet been officially taken, despite the fact that everybody understands that this is going to be the case. One of the discussions between companies is creating a pipeline and going from the Eastern Mediterranean towards Turkey. Mm-hmm. From where is this pipeline going to pass? Either from the economic zones of Lebanon and Syria, something that it is totally unrealistic, or through Cyprus, sea and land. Mm. In this case, I think that everybody realizes that it's only with a settlement of the Cyprus question that this can be achieved. And I don't think that Israel will connive to the creation of a fait accompli and a by force immersion of a pipeline, ignoring the Republic of Cyprus. Another example, even more important, is the fact that we are saying that this wealth, although we are looking for it only in the southern seas of Cyprus, the economic zone is around the island.
And we are saying that this wealth belongs to all Cypriots.
Mm.
And the fund that will be created, which is destined for the future generations, along the Norwegian model, where scholarships, research programs, whatever will be offered, this will be all Cypriots, irrespective of which community they are coming from, will be entitled. But nobody expects that we'll take money and give hand to the self-proclaimed illegal entity in the north, just like this. After a settlement, we will settle our accounts. And the same, I want to tell you something, because sometimes Turkey tends to forget. Turkey says we should leave it there until we get a settlement.
You mean leave it in the
under
the water?
Sea.
Yeah.
There's something else. From 1974 until the 1980s, the Republic of Cyprus was providing electricity to everywhere, occupied part, to Turkish Cypriots, to everywhere, because we were obliged to do. The authorities were charging the consumer, were taking the money from the consumer, Turkish Cypriot community, and then they said they will hand nothing to the electricity authority of Cyprus until a settlement of the question, then we will settle our accounts. Likewise.
Prime Minister, you gave a fairly detailed proposal for resolving the conflict. I wonder if you could just tell us, to those of us who are unschooled in all of the details, was there something new in what you put forward today? Or is this long-standing position?
No. Today I have given two very specific and important examples of not hiding behind the known path, the wooden language, the path that if a politician hides behind, risks nothing. But this reminds me of the individual who wants to avoid being run down by a car, and he never leaves his house. If we need to do something, we have to bring forward answers to problems. And we propose two things that will improve two important matters. First, the problem between the European Union and NATO, and secondly, the need to bridge the gap of trust between the two sides, while negotiating, they will negotiate in much better terms.
Okay, let's go to your questions. Please wait for the microphone, and please identify yourself to the minister. Over here.
Thank you, sir. I'm Mustafa Tunç, a Turkish Cypriot from the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus Representative Office in Washington. I have two questions to you. First of all, 2 days ago, NATO Secretary General Anders Rasmussen stated that issues between EU and NATO can be resolved completely only after the Cyprus question is solved, and that natural resources like the natural gas can only be exploited after a solution to the Cyprus problem. What is your comment on this? And secondly, a question on reliability of the Greek Cypriot government. During the previous phases of bicommunal talks, it was agreed in principle that delimitation of maritime zones in Cyprus will be left to the joint federal government after the resolution of the Cyprus problem. Yes, your administration not only signed delimitation agreements with Egypt, Israel, and Lebanon, as you have mentioned, but also started drilling natural gas. What is your comment on this? This puts your reliability in our eyes in question. Thank you very much.
Thank you. First of all, I want to express pleasure that I have a Cypriot compatriot to speak with and have a frank dialogue on the questions he has put. The first is regarding a statement by the Secretary General of NATO. I must say that when I first read the statement, it was from Turkish press. And I said to myself, has he really said this, Secretary General? Then we got him on tape, because he was giving a press conference. And we got exactly what he said. Please ask them in Nicosia when they send you this information, whether he said really that he wants the exploitation of the natural gas to take place after the solution. He didn't say this. As for the first, that the problems between NATO and the European Union will be solved once the problem is solved, fully, as you have said quite rightly, fully, yes, I agree. But this doesn't stop to take the opportunity to resolve this problem, not fully, but satisfactorily with the proposal that we are making. What's wrong? Turkey belongs to NATO. Greece belongs to NATO. We are asking to participate in a program of NATO and in this way remove the excuse of preventing the dialogue between the two, between the alliance and the union. Let me say that the reason given is that Turkey does not recognize us, Cyprus, the Republic of Cyprus, and therefore they don't want to sit with us at the same table in NATO. Yeah, but they are sitting with us in the intergovernmental conference that is negotiating the accession terms of Turkey to join the European Union. They are sitting exactly, it is Turkey on the one side and the 27 and tomorrow 28 on the other side. What's the problem? We don't need to have diplomatic relations with somebody in order to sit at the same table. Now, the second, I don't know what you are talking about, this reliability. Okay, you may say a lot of things, and I can say also. No, I understood your question.
Just on the other hand, just starting to drill them unilaterally, that puts...
No, it's not what you said.
Right.
Your question was that during the talks, Christofias, I don't know whom you're referring to, has agreed that we will do nothing, no drilling, no nothing, and wait for the federal government of Cyprus to decide. I never heard that there was any such agreement anywhere. Has Mr. Christofias hidden this for us? I don't. It's too big to be hidden away. So I don't think that these facts are true. The question of the natural gas is totally independent from the problem of Cyprus. When you have a division and you sustain a division and you know that there were times and periods where lost opportunities were due to the one side, on other periods of time were due to the other side. But if we have these kind of divisions and you have to apply also international law in the United Nations Convention for the Law of the Sea, you have to do it. With the government that is legally recognized has to proceed, and then we will settle whatever needs to be settled when we find a settlement of the Cyprus question.
Other questions? Yes, please.
Hello, Robert Shredda of International Investor. Quick question. I realize you're the Minister of Foreign Affairs, but the economic crisis was such that here in the Western media, it's all we heard about for the last year. if one was to believe it, they would think Cyprus was going to follow Atlantis to the bottom of the Mediterranean Sea. Was that exaggerated, and to what degree does it affect your job as Minister of Foreign Affairs, knowing that this crisis was of such great concern, not just to the European banks and central bank, but to all the Western financial institutions?
Yes, very good question. Thank you very much for this. This gives me the opportunity to, let me have a look at the watch, if I'm not abusing the time. Gives me the opportunity, first of all, to say a few words about this economic crisis, which, first of all, we should all understand that much of the responsibility lies with Cyprus first and most, which has allowed things to come to the precipice of both the economy of the state and the banking economy at the same time, where the choices that you had when you went to negotiate with your partners in the Eurozone were almost zero. The bargaining power, first of all. Second is the fact that it was a mistake to have such a big banking sector with a very high deposit interest rate, the highest in Europe, because apart from attracting capitals from abroad, it incited Cypriots to put their money in the banks, not invest them, and not spend them in the real economy. And then the interest rates for lending money were higher than the deposit rates, that's natural in any bank, and therefore this was very detrimental to the economy. That's for the responsibilities of Cyprus. Now, I maintain that Cyprus, because of its small size and its limited systemicity, if I can use this word, was allowed to serve as an experiment answering the biggest question, what to do about banks too big to fail? Yes? Can banks indefinitely make reckless decisions and take risks, feeling that at any moment the taxpayers' money will come and rescue them? This has been for Europe a great big question, and the opportunity was offered through Cyprus to give the warning and the example for the rest. But unfortunately, it didn't permit us to readjust all the wrongdoings of our economy, let's say within a three-year period, instead of this brutal and overnight collapse of our banking system. That's for a great resume of the economic crisis. Let me say that we are resilient people. It happened to us before with the Turkish invasion in 1974, where we had also one-third of our population which were displaced to cater for. And we started already putting down the policies, the engine of the private sector. I remind you that we are not a left-wing government, and now we can easily make the best of use of the private sector, which will regenerate the economy and will bring us, after a few painful years, back on track with a much better and healthier banking and financial system. Now, has this influenced our foreign policy? Initially, we received a shock also on designing our foreign policy. But then I think that it's giving us much more impetus now. I have said in several interviews that I am feeling as foreign minister much more liberated now to speak up my mind, to portray dignity in the foreign policy of Cyprus and not lip service to nobody, because we have nothing to lose, and follow a foreign policy, the one that I have described to you, because the biggest part is our regional policy, as I have described it, and be afraid of nobody.
Thank you.
Interesting. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I have one close-out question for you. Do you think that Secretary Kerry should appoint a new envoy for Cyprus?
Well, I'll discuss it tomorrow with Secretary Kerry. I appreciate very much the fact that he has invited me to come to Washington in such a very short period of time after he has taken over as Secretary of State. I appreciate the interest that he shows in our region. He came three times, and he's going for a fourth time now, as you have said, to Israel and the Palestinians, where he's trying to broker the beginning, the resumption of the Middle East peace process without preconditions from any side. Now, he's most welcome if he wants to be involved, hands-on, as they say, but he should know where the difficulties lie, in particular the need that any solution should be fair to the two allies, Israel and Turkey, and not allow the solution of Cyprus to lose the necessary balance by having the sort of knee-jerk that Turkey should be supported. The solution of the Cyprus problem needs to be fair, needs to address the problems of both sides, of all Cypriots, and needs the approval of all Cypriots. And if governments can be complacent, public opinion is not. And when we go to a referendum, we should not wake up with another surprise, because it would be fatal.
Framas Kasalaitis, thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking the Minister.